ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When the police raided the Stonewall Inn back in 1969, they had no idea that it would eventually lead to the birth of gay pride.
We started standing up for ourselves and said, this is who we are and you're going to accept us.
I'm Mark Fennell and I am the host of the ABC Radio National podcast, No One Saw It Coming. Each week, we unravel a moment in history that changed the course of the world, but, well, no one saw it coming. To hear it, search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sprinklers are the sound of summer in Australia. But from the big ones to smaller ones to a row of drippers in a strawberry patch, sprinkler systems are not just a soundtrack. They've changed the face of Australia. It's a revolution that we've hardly noticed. But what happens when the water runs out? I'm Jonathan Webb, and this is Lab Notes from ABC Radio National. Today, I'm joined by James Pertill. James is our technology reporter in the Radio National Science Unit, and he's been diving deep into the science and the history of sprinkling. G'day, James.
Hello, Jonathan.
You're a technology reporter. You spend your time on things like solar power and electric cars and artificial intelligence. Sprinklers seem quite low tech by comparison, but they are incredibly significant to Australia as we know it, aren't they?
Yeah, they're definitely not AI. But the thing I like about sprinklers is they're so low tech and familiar that we don't even look at them. We bury them. They're kept out of sight. But when you consider their cumulative aggregate impact, it's amazing. You know, whole cities can stay green while the bush around them turns brittle and dries up every summer. And we know this, well, we can kind of see the effects of this because all the kangaroos come into the cities and all the cockatoos flock into these backyards to have something to feed on. You know, it allows for all this great gardening culture that we have in Australia and for us to sort of stay cool during heat waves and things like that. And the sprinkler is the essential technology there because we just don't have time to stand around holding a hose with our busy modern lives.
Take us back to what sprinklers were like 100 years ago.
They were made of brass and galvanized iron. They might have a canvas hose and they were kind of a heavy, clunky thing that you drag around the lawn. It kind of came right after the invention of the suburban lawn in the 19th century. So in the US, you get the suburban lawn, and then soon after you get the sprinkler. And it kind of indicates that we've just always been looking to find ways to save time with the gardening, right? and that situation, yeah, basically lasted for a long time, right up until the 60s. You kind of had improvements in designs, but essentially, you know, the same material, and that was made it heavy and expensive.
But then suddenly things started to change a bit, and this is all tracked in a beautiful feature that you wrote for the ABC News website, a couple of weekends ago, and it hinges on a few Australian kind of knockabout innovators.
Yeah, tinkerers who got really rich. And the first of those was a guy called Bill Antal. He was in Adelaide. He was an irrigation pump repair man who read in an article about a new kind of plastic and thought, maybe we could make a sprinkler head out of that. And that was in the 60s. He made a few and they sold out. And that, along with, you know, some other providers, was the sort of launch of the plastic sprinkler in Australia, which is now so ubiquitous, right? But back then, they were just, you know, it just started out as a handful made by this bloke in Adelaide.
To begin with, they didn't make it straight into everyone's backyards. You write that they were mostly a thing you found in orchards.
Yeah, because when you think of it, I mean, you know, it's great that you've got a plastic sprinkler, but what are you going to run that sprinkler off? So if you're going to run it off the mains water supply, you're going to have to be turning the sprinklers on and off throughout the day to water your garden. There wasn't any automation technology. And so plastic sprinklers combined with automation was the next breakthrough that allowed for really kind of lush suburban gardens. And the place that this happened was Perth, where I'm from. So Perth was a very dry, sandy place with a great interest in growing lawns. And a small company called Hugo and Hoyle, which mostly dug boreholes, figured out a way to automate these sprinkler systems and essentially run a big garden-wide network of irrigation off the mains water supply. I mean, that sounds kind of simple, but no one else was doing it at the time.
Right.
Pretty much anywhere in the world. California was doing it a bit.
So the breakthrough came from Hugel and Hoyle in Perth. An amazing name for a company. It sounds like a, you know, a bookshop in Harry Potter or something, but I've literally never heard of this. I gather they're a bit of a household name where you're from.
Well, they were. They're not really around anymore. But yeah, back in the 80s, they were a big deal. And it just meant that people could water a huge garden without much work. So a man who actually was my year six cricket coach, Wally Edwards.
Okay.
So when I knew him, I was vaguely aware that, you know, but when he was coaching me cricket, vaguely aware that he was doing something in irrigation. And then 20 years later or so, I learned that he'd sold his company for $160 million. His company was called Holman Industries, and it became the largest supplier of irrigation supplies to Bunnings. And he kind of pioneered the switch from installing irrigation being a professional service to something that you could do DIY, which meant that more people could afford it, which meant, yeah, more sprinkler systems in the suburbs. And Wally Edwards, yeah, he also played cricket for Australia. It's an amazing character.
Multi-talented. And, yeah. and coach James Purtill, for which we will always be grateful. You also describe this type of system, which Wally pioneered, as adult Lego, which is a brilliant description and kind of encapsulates that tinkerer's appeal, I guess, of being able to figure out the system yourself and add a little extra bit when you put in a strawberry patch or whatever it might be.
That's right. I mean, adult Lego was kind of my way into the story because it's how I've been spending my weekends. I live in Perth and we have a very dry climate, and I'm just spending a lot of time trying to get the garden watered with sprinklers. And so I sort of started to wonder how many other people were doing that and why the irrigation aisle at the hardware store was just so busy all the time. And that's how I got into this story.
Fascinating. The shape of the suburbs and the greening of them wasn't the only thing changing, was it? In the background, there is a change looming to the globe's climate, which in turn is starting to affect the balance of this sort of equation of how we green our suburbs.
There's an amazing statistic here. So Perth was one of the first cities in the world to experience the impact of climate change. I mean, that's a sort of recognised fact. From 1970 onwards, its rainfall declined 20%. That's, you know, 20%, it's a lot, but you might not think it's too much. But because the ground dried out, when the rain fell, it just got soaked up. So stream flow declined 80%.
Wow.
So there was just no water running into the dams. In 1970, Perth relied on rain for all of its water. By 2026, it's about 8%.
Where does the rest come from if it's no longer coming out of the sky and out of the rivers?
Well, partly from the ground. There's artesian water, but...
So bores in...
Yeah, bores.
In backyards or in sort of big parks and stuff, that's where the water comes
from? Yeah, and big industrial-scale bores that are, you know, used by the water authority. So that's a big part. But increasingly and significantly, it's desalination. So that's filtering the salt out of seawater, and tens of billions of litres of that is produced in Perth every year. It's the largest producer of desal in Australia by a long, long way. And, you know, it's comparable to anything that's happening around the world, including in the Middle East. So without that desalination, I've heard from experts that, you know, Perth would probably cease to exist. It just would be very hard to support a city, at least of this size, without desal.
Wow. We also know there's huge benefits to be found from green spaces in cities. How do we reconcile that with the increasing scarcity of water? Do we need to say goodbye to the sprinkler as the icon of the Australian summer?
It's an amazing technology, desal, but it has its drawbacks. And I think it is going to force us to reassess what we keep green. We really need green cities to survive the heat, to avoid that urban heat island effect. Green spaces are really, really important, but I think we need to be a bit more selective about how we create those spaces and who gets to use them. You know, are they public spaces? Are they places that anyone can go to in a heatwave, or is it something more exclusive?
James Pertill, thank you very much for sharing your lab notes with me.
Thank you, Jonathan.
This episode of Lab Notes was produced on Gadigal, Menang Noongar and Whadjuk Boodja country. Our producer is Fiona Pepper, and I'm Jonathan Webb. Catch you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.